Welcome to the Design Thinking Roundtable. I'm Anne-Laure Fayard, an ethnographer studying social innovation. In this series, Social Innovators in Residence, I converse with passionate and inspiring social innovators who are visiting us at the ERA Chair in Social Innovation and the DESIS Lab at Nova SB. Today, I'm delighted to be in conversation with Liz Gerber, a professor at Northwestern University, co-director of Northwestern Center for Human-Computer Interaction Plus Design, and faculty founder of Design for America, a national award-winning network of interdisciplinary students who work together to solve problems they care about in their community. Liz works is at the intersection of design, social computing, and organizational behavior to understand the future of collaboration and social impact. Liz, it's a pleasure to have you today for our Design Thinking Roundtable podcast and to have you all this week as a social innovator in residence.
Thank you very much.
You know, as I was reviewing your work, your education, I could not think of anything else than what a perfect example of a boundary spanner. Across discipline, across practice, when I think about your professional experience as a designer, social scientist, manager, academic work is like crossing also boundaries between human-computer interaction, psychology, social science. So I'm just curious, like, how do you get to this multifaceted experience? Is there like a people that you met? Are there moments that kind of led to this situation of going in between?
Thank you for having me here, and what a great question. As a child, I was fortunate to have parents and many adults in my life who did many different things. My grandparents moved to a small town and had to figure out a way to make a living, and so they did farming. They made a hotel. They did real estate. They did law, and they helped out with the local fire department. And so, in a small town, they had to do lots of different things. They were always very inspirational to me. And then two other very strong influences are my mother, who was a photography professor at the time, and we were living in Hong Kong, and she would take me out to take photographs, and I would follow along, and we'd go into markets and move around the community. And there was one time, and she would be taking photos, and I would be having my own conversations with people on the streets, obviously in the shared, with lots of hand waving and gestures. And there was this one moment when I remember there was a man who was doing dental work, and he was sitting, a Chinese man who was sitting between the sidewalk and the road, that little grassy area, with all his tools displayed, and he was doing dental work on people. And I remember being fascinated by, one, the fact that he was there doing, he looked very different than my dentist back in the United States. Two, I loved all his tools and equipment and the big suitcase he had with all the details. And three, that we communicated. I was six, he was perhaps 75, and we had a point of connection. And so for me, that's a moment when I realized I was interested in social science, people, design, as well as organizational structure and work. How does work get done? Now, that was a moment when everything came together for me. I really struggled in school because everything was separated. I wanted to do every major, or at least five. They were all on different parts of the on the campus, and everybody told me that they didn't work well together, and I had to focus and choose. And that was very upsetting to me as a young girl and as a teenager and a college student. And so it is with great joy that I've finally merged my interests.
I really like the story of the Hong Kong. You know, all of the others are nice, but like I can imagine you at six, like trying to make sense of what was going on.
What was going on? And the best part was, from a parenting perspective, is my mom knew where I was, but she was not hovering. She was doing her own work. So she was not getting in my way of doing my own research. And I don't know if that would happen.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. So you had like, it's freedom, flexibility to, you know, you have a structure, but enough space to play and experiment on your own.
Yes.
Feeling safe also.
Feeling very safe and not concerned about talking with this man. And I use talking.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Communicating. So, yeah, that was a moment that I think back on often, of loving every part of the moment. And I think it just instantiates where I am today.
And so I think, like, talking about this, like, these conditions for trying out things and really experimenting kind of led me to Design for America, which is where we kind of first met through Design for America, although we discovered that, in fact, it was at a research talk at NYU. But and I think that for me, you know, the whole starting point of DFA, you with a few students, and then kind of moving on later on, is and really trying to create a community and giving students this space. So if you could just tell me, like, what was really the starting point, and then any kind of learning along the ways. I know that the organization has evolved quite a bit, but like any kind of, you know, things where you're like, wow, that's exactly what I was hoping for, or maybe. And I know you're still thinking about, like, how do we go from the idea to the implementation, but like any kind of learning on, like, how do we create these spaces for people to really do social impact and not only dream it or talk it.
So I'll start first about the conditions, mm-hmm. which I had observed through my own experience in formal education, and then also when I was teaching at Stanford as a graduate student, which is, there's a couple of them. One is interesting things happen at the intersections of disciplines. And again, this will go back to my original statement of, you know, so often we take our majors in individual classes, and we speak with people who speak the same language, who don't question our core assumptions, and we don't come up with new ideas, consequently. And so how can we work across disciplines was one question I had. The other one was, when are we willing to take risks? And I think in an increasingly risk-adverse culture, it's hard to create spaces where we can take risks that feel and reflect and learn from them. And I have observed higher ed, the classroom, being a place where people want the top grade and will do everything at the cost of getting the top grade. And some of the most interesting learning experiences that I experienced and I observing other people had were happening at 2 a.m. in the morning in somebody's apartment among a group of friends talking or exchanging ideas or building upon an idea. It was not in the classroom between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. It was outside. So the insight that some of the most exciting learning happens outside the classroom was one, and another part of that is that it's out of there's a freedom from grades. It's curiosity and exploration because you want to, rather than an expectation of evaluation. So how could we create conditions where there was less perceived evaluation, or the risk of the cost of failure was less? And then the third part of it was the feedback cycle, shortening the feedback cycle of the impact of your ideas. So as I said, teacher evaluation is one thing, but really evaluation and feedback from the community with whom you are working to understand how you're connecting, what ideas you have, what ideas they have, and whether they're working or not. My conviction in design education is we create a lot of ideas that we put in a box and ship to somebody else, and then they sit and gather dust because people don't actually use them. They say they'll use them, but they don't. And so one of the ideas was, how do we actually get honest feedback and shorten the feedback cycle of understanding the impact of our work? And that can be really scary for people to put an idea out there and get, you know, to see it flop, and then get back out and put it out there again and see it flop and see it flop. So I think there's really about, it's thinking about the environment and the role of feedback and reducing the apprehension connected to evaluation that's incredibly important. So you asked, over the years, so now the organization has scaled greatly. And so the questions are less at the individual level and the team level and more around networks. And how do you create healthy, sustainable networks of people who are committed and people who are there long term to carry the knowledge forward. So the scaling questions are very different than how do you create individual environments for risk taking.
I think you have like more than 40 studios now.
Yes.
Yes. And so, you know, to me, it seems, I think I read like they were, you know, more than 4,000, you know, students and educators and working, you know, on projects for DFA or Design for America. But like, I think it's what you're pointing at is like, how do we move from also a collection of projects to something that has a, you know, an impact over time?
Yes.
And that, you know, it's not just, even if a project, you know, not a project that is in a box.
Yes.
No, not a project that is. No. So I think that's one thing that I'm hearing. And I think the other part that we discussed before, which I think is really key to DFA, is the local.
The hyper-local. Right. So one of the most important parts of any work that you do on, especially in innovation, is passion. You cannot do innovation without passion. And the reason is because you will come, as you know, come across many, many, many obstacles. So you have to have conviction and excitement and a reason, a really strong reason. And I think part of that reason for acting is creating relationships and building trust with local community members and creating long-term relationships, not in and out, but really wanting to first connect and build relationships. And then, if there is trust established, then co-creating together. And then the implementation and sustainability becomes a lot more natural because everybody's played into it. People have contributed and feel greater ownership to it. And they want to do it because they have the human relationship, not because it was a project and now it is done. I think this is becoming increasingly challenging in our society with people's attention spans being much shorter and relationship development being challenging for people. And so, and yet I also think that's what's attractive to students is to have longer term relationships with people. So it's both frightening and exciting.
And I guess what you're pointing at is really what's the motivation and, you know, intrinsic versus extrinsic, because grade is it's typical.
It's all intrinsic.
Yeah.
I think we as educators owe it to our students. While we're part of the system that runs on extrinsic motivation, I think our duty is to help students understand what intrinsically motivates them. Mm-hmm. I was in a conversation with one of your students yesterday, and she was explaining, she gave me a 5-minute presentation on her idea, but there was one moment when she had a big smile and her eyes lit up. And I said, that's what you should focus on.
Yeah.
And it was, the moment was she was talking about a seamstress she had met in Uganda and a conversation she had with her. And mm-hmm. I said, that's where your heart is. What's happening there?
So, I think it kind of summarized, but maybe it will also kind of lead to another idea. Is like, I read on your website this statement, it takes a village to raise a kid. Parents alone can't do it. And then you continue and you argue that we need new ideas to help save our planet, keep health care accessible, and strengthen democracy. To raise those ideas, I create villages. Which I think, you know, this idea that we need to raise ideas, so this idea of care.
Care.
And so is DFA, all these studios, villages? And what are the other villages you're trying to create to help us raise these new ideas?
Oh, I like that. Thank you. I think DFA is not a village. It's one. It's,
many villages.
It's, no, it's. I think it's one sibling.
Okay.
So I think of ecosystems as quite large. It's, you cannot, DFA alone will not get you where okay. you need to get. Mm-hmm. It's, there's many different, many different resources. There's your family, there's your friends, there's what's happening in the cities, how they're supporting you, the different incubators, the different community partners that you speak with. It's so much bigger. And I think that's a statement that I think the personification of innovation is a single person in a room with a light bulb above their head. Mm-hmm. And it couldn't be more wrong. It's never a single person with a light bulb. It's thousands and thousands of people. And yet, in the media, we like to put the face of Steve Jobs as the
hero.
He's the hero of Apple, and we have heroes. But the hero model is not how any innovation happens. That's an oversimplified story that dismisses the role, the critical role of so many people that played a part. And we just don't, that I think students get really confused by, I think that image does not serve us well, because we dismiss the role of people, the critical role of people in making something happen.
And I think, you know, you talked a bit about the failure, and I think it's also that, because the heroic image makes it like really hard to think that you might fail, or that, you know, even the heroes, if you look historically at, like, you know, the scientists, the artists, etc., we know only the successes.
That's also right. So we do two fallacies. We show a single hero, not an army of people. And then we only show the victory scene, not all the failures.
Yes.
And it's not how it works. I was telling one of your students yesterday that I'm writing a book, but I said I'm first writing a bad book. And they laughed. They said, why are you saying that? And I said, well, because I'm gonna do so many iterations of this. Of course the first one's gonna be bad. That's my expectation, as opposed to the first one's gonna be great. Another thing around this book is I say I'm writing a book, and I realized I'm not writing a book. I have a team with whom I'm writing a book. And so those are two reframes. I'm not a single person creating. I'm on a team. I'm creating a team. And I'm going to learn a lot from it. It's going to be bad.
So what's this good, bad, in-between book is going to be about? Now you got me curious.
Well, it's around this idea of pivoting. And how is it that, given in the world, we're constantly faced with changes, whether it be personal, in our personal lives, a child comes home and identifies, my child came home and identified as non-binary. Okay, that was a change. How do I respond to that? That was very personal to very professional. The pandemic hit, and I'm used to teaching in person, and all of a sudden I must teach remotely in a hands-on way. So how do we pivot? And how do we reliably pivot instead of become paralyzed by that? And I have a three-part answer, which is currently, one is around reframing, experimenting with new directions, and then reaching out, which are themes that are here, obviously. So reframing it as, rather than the worst thing that's happened, perhaps it's the best thing that happened. Or experimenting with lots of different ways of going forward, new ways of going forward when the old one isn't working. And then one I've already mentioned, which is reaching out for help and support. I think, the idea that we are capable of doing things alone is an absolute fallacy. So how do we reach out and create our team?
I can't wait to read the book.
Well, it's going
to
be bad. So
well, it's fine. I'll still enjoy it, you know. And I'm sure you'll keep the bad book and you'll share the better book, whatever it is.
Okay.
It is.
Okay.
I think, for me, good books are the ones that make you think. And I can see you asking a lot of questions and getting people to think about, you know, some of their assumptions.
Some of the assumptions that we have. Yeah, I think we have a lot of assumptions.
And so to finish, I'd like to ask you a last question that we've been thinking about for a while. In fact, I was thinking that, you know, you invited me to this super inspiring workshop, 2018 or something like that, around scaling design thinking, that you organize with a few colleagues, as always, you know, collaboratively.
Huge team.
And so this question of, like, and I think, again, you've been talking a lot about, like, what are the trends, and scaling and impact are two big trends. So I'm just curious, like, what's for you the, you know, I sometimes think about, like, scaling is not necessarily about numbers and breadth and reach. You know, it's not how many customers you have or how many users you have on your platform. And I guess, so I'm just curious, like, what's your thinking, and probably linked also to pivoting about scaling and can we scale forever?
So been thinking a lot about scaling. People are really obsessed with scaling. Bigger is better. Mm-hmm. The fallacy in that is time is limited. You can only do so many things. And there are certain things that can I do believe can scale limitlessly, love, connection, relationships. Mm-hmm. But there's some things that have a limit. And so how do we think about if we're building something up, what are we taking away? And I used to start every day with a list of 100 things to do. I was very ambitious and I wanted to get everything done. And then I realized I was always trying to do too much. I wasn't taking anything away. And so now I start every day with a list of 3 things. I still don't get everything done, but I'm getting better. And so it's about being like a realism of what can be done and what cannot be done. In terms of scaling design thinking, one of the things that I've observed since being a part of the design thinking movement, if you will, since the early 2000s, is there's scaling breadth to a large number of people, and there's scaling depth and understanding. And I think what we've done is scaled breadth. A lot of people know the term. And what's interesting is as we scale broadly, if you interviewed people, you'd get very different definitions. Mm-hmm. Some people would say design thinking is about post-it notes. That's what it's about. Other people would say, oh, design thinking is about empathy and understanding others. And it's scaled so broadly, it almost doesn't mean anything. Mm-hmm. There's not a shared understanding anymore. And then there's other people who have really thought about going very, very deep with it and have done some, I think, have done some really interesting work in terms of application areas to medicine, to career design, to policy, law and policy is fascinating to me. And religion. I recently was talking to religious leaders who were interested in using design thinking in their church. I thought I'd never thought I would be having this conversation. But what resonated with them was the empathy. They were very interested in the empathy piece. Anyway, that's an aside. So scaling. So there's breadth and depth, and too often we focus on number of people and dollars. Those are our mm-hmm. easily quantified numbers. And those are just two measures and often the ones that don't matter. And so I think more about the way I'm thinking more about scaling is having meaningful interactions with a smaller number of people that are very deep, and then having those people share with others. So it's more of a train the trainers model rather than a broadcast, a message to mm-hmm. lots and lots of people who do not understand the concept. And I think that's where some of the pushback on design thinking is coming right now, is so many people are just sick of hearing it. They've heard it broadcasted for so long, but there's not a deep understanding. And so it's some people would say it's declining in popularity. What I do think is interesting is that there's other practices that are built upon the same foundation that are increasing in popularity. And so I think the fundamentals of it will stay for a long time, but perhaps the particular flavor and branding of it will decline.
Yeah, I was so completely aligned on the how things have been broadcasted and maybe lost the kind of a spirit.
The spirit, or the, yeah. Right.
But also sharing with you, I think that some of his principle, and because the history of it was, you know, participatory design and design like the Scandinavian school of, yes. of design, etc. So I think that, to your point, I think that the principles around, in the end, a lot of the topics that you talked about, which is really care, relationships, mm-hmm. which is really at the core of understanding context.
That's right. Those have been around for...
Working with rather than for will hopefully stay, partly if we want to have like social impact.
Yes.
So yeah, I completely agree. But I like this model of moving to this idea of train the trainer types of model, because I think it's also giving accountability and taking away the risk of losing too much in translation.
Yes. Well, and I think it's also, and one thing I don't like about Train the Trainer is it sounds one directional.
Yes, but
and
it's,
I didn't, it's really exchange.
It isn't.
There, we need a new term. Learn together, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, no, I see.
Learning exchange, because I always learn, for example, working with these religious leaders, I learned a tremendous amount from them about how they think about, empathy often. Mm-hmm. In a very different way than I think about it. And so hearing how they think about empathy, hearing how they think about reframing, they don't use those words. They don't use the word iteration, but they're
doing it.
They're doing it. Mm-hmm. And it was just it was so exciting to be in conversation with these people. I thought that in which we shared no common process, and actually perhaps we did.
I mean, I think that's, it's a great way to also end on this idea of like, how can we learn from others?
Yes.
And that being agnostic about the terms and mm-hmm. just caring for the practice mm-hmm. and what we links also to this notion of motivation and intrinsic motivation mm-hmm. that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the kind of the terms that I would keep from our conversation, this notion of passion mm-hmm. for motivation, care and relationship, humility, which is against our heroic views of the world, and collaboration or working with or connection, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is the title of your talk for Thursday. So thank you so much for sharing, you know, with so much generosity today and all over this week. It's a pleasure to have you here at Nova.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Design Thinking Roundtable, produced by the DESIS Lab and ERA Chair in Social Innovation at Nova SBE, in partnership with the Design Lab at NYU Makerspace. This episode was recorded at Fidelidad Creative Studio.